For the last speech of our convention, and we'll have a brief special presentation following this speech, but for the last speech of the convention, I want to introduce a longtime friend of mine, Rick Brookhiser. Rick and I go back to college at Yale together, and he's had an illustrious career as a writer, going back to when he was either 14 or 15, I've never been quite sure, when he first wrote an article for National Review. He's been writing ever since. He's been with NR, although a number of other places, but with National Review in some sense ever since. But he's written for numerous other publications, and more significantly, he's become a major historian of the founding period. Among his 10 books are biographies of George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, Governor Morris, and the Adamses. And he has now ventured forth to write a book entitled James Madison, which seems entirely appropriate for us to hear about. And he, in addition to speaking about this book, at our closing reception tonight, he will be signing copies of it. But first, we're gonna ask him to give us a little bit of a taste of the book. Rick?
Thank you, Gene. Thank you very much. Gene and I go way back, as he said. We met in the administration of Richard Nixon. So that was a long time ago. Greetings from New York City, the home of Occupy Wall Street. If after my talk you decide you don't like James Madison and the Constitution, you can rule yourselves the way they do with drumming circles and, you know, raising hands. Bad idea? Well, we'll see. You can judge. James Madison had two children. His wife, Dolly, had one, John Payne Todd, who became his stepson after they were married. And he was a bit of a cross for his stepfather. But he's not important to history. But Madison's own two children are very important to our history. And they are the Constitution and slightly younger, but equally vigorous, modern American politics. And I just want to briefly talk about those this afternoon. Madison was called the father of the Constitution in his own lifetime. And that does not mean that he got the Constitution he wanted. None of the signers of the Constitution got exactly the document they wanted. All of them had to surrender on some points, give up something. But Madison is rightly called the father of the Constitution because at every stage of the planning, the writing, the ratifying, and the passage of the Bill of Rights, Madison and only Madison was a major player. In 1786, he and Alexander Hamilton hijacked a conference on commercial regulation in Annapolis, Maryland, and turned it into a call for a constitutional convention in Philadelphia the following year. When the constitutional convention opened in May of 1787, James Madison was a delegate from Virginia. He was the first out-of-towner to show up. He attended every session. He spoke more often than any other delegate except Governor Morris and James Wilson. And he took notes every day of all the motions that were made and of all the speeches that were given. These notes were published after his death in 1840 and have been mined by historians and scholars ever since. When the Constitution left Philadelphia, it declared that it would go into effect when 9 of 13 states had ratified. But it couldn't be any 9. There were several must-have states, and Madison was a major player in 2 of those states. He led the ratification forces in Virginia, which was then the largest state in the country. It included what's now West Virginia and Kentucky. It was the most populous state. It certainly thought of itself as the most eminent state, and probably every other state would have agreed. Madison led the forces for the Constitution, going head-to-head with Patrick Henry, and he beat him. Virginia very narrowly ratified the Constitution. He was also a major player in New York, where Alexander Hamilton got him to collaborate into a propaganda campaign in the New York newspapers. The other co-author was John Jay, an older man, a diplomat. Jay got sick very early in this process, so most of the work had to be done by Hamilton and Madison. Of course, these were the Federalist Papers. They appeared in the New York newspapers at the rate of 4 a week. Each one is about 2,000 words long. An op-ed piece today is typically 750 words, so this was a brutal pace that these authors kept. Hamilton ended up writing 51, Madison wrote 29, but several of the most important are among Madison's contributions. Then after the Constitution was ratified, Madison was elected as a congressman from Virginia in the first Congress, and there he made it one of his tasks to put a Bill of Rights on the agenda of the House of Representatives. The House's action prompted the Senate to act, and then in the fall of 1789, 12 amendments went out to the country. The proposed First Amendment had to do with the size of congressional districts, and it was never ratified. The proposed Second Amendment had to do with congressional pay, and that was not ratified until 1992, when it became the 27th Amendment. But the original amendments, 3 through 12, were ratified rather quickly. They became the first 10 amendments, and the similarity of 10 amendments to another famous set of 10 laws makes Madison, in effect, the secular Moses of the Bill of Rights. So if Madison had been struck by a carriage and killed in November of 1789, his role as father of the Constitution would have been almost complete. But he had a second child to give birth to. And this child begins to come into the world in 1791. And the cause is Madison's former friend and ally, Alexander Hamilton. George Washington becomes the first president. Hamilton is the first Treasury Secretary. Madison's oldest and dearest friend, Thomas Jefferson, is the first Secretary of State. And Madison is the leading man in the House of Representatives. Representative Fisher Ames calls him our first man. So it seems like there is a united cadre of leadership for the beginning of the new government under the Constitution. But, of course, politics never rests, and soon they split apart. And one of the causes is Hamilton's financial program. Now, Hamilton was a former merchant's clerk from the West Indies. He thought he was bringing the United States into a new world of finance and commerce. James Madison was a Virginia planter, so was Thomas Jefferson. They looked at this new world with suspicion and alarm. Madison also had constitutional questions about important features of it. It's not important to me here now who was right or wrong in this dispute. What I'd like to focus on is what James Madison does about it. How do you stop or slow down Alexander Hamilton when he seems to be in the tide of success? The first thing Madison does is to take a vacation. In the summer of 1791, he leaves Philadelphia, which is the nation's capital, and he goes to New York City. He's soon joined by his friend Thomas Jefferson, the Secretary of State. They go up the Hudson River, they go to Lake George and Lake Champlain, then they cut over to New England, go south, cross Long Island Sound, come back to New York City for some more time, and then they go back to Philadelphia. And it's amazing to me how many Madison and Jefferson biographers today accept this cover story. And they say they were just relaxing. They were fishing. They shot squirrels. Jefferson wrote a letter to his daughter Polly on a piece of birch bark from a canoe in Lake George. They were really relaxing in the beauties of upstate New York. The other view comes from a lawyer in New York at the time who was a good friend of Alexander Hamilton, also of Aaron Burr. And he writes, his name is Robert Troup, He writes Hamilton a letter in Philadelphia, and he says there's every sign of a passionate courtship between Madison, Jefferson, and New York politicians who have their own quarrels with Alexander Hamilton. One of these is Robert Livingston, the man who gave the oath of office to George Washington. He's head of the Court of Chancery in the state of New York. Another is Senator Aaron Burr, a young and rising New York politician. And Troup is warning Hamilton that the Virginians have been talking to these guys. Now, what were they doing? They were looking for peers and allies in other states. If you're going to try and stop or roll back the country's new financial policy, you can't do it just from Virginia. You have to have allies everywhere. So this trip to New York is the first step in building a national alliance, in building a national party. Madison christens the party in early 1792. He calls it the Republican Party. And that is the name it will have for 30 years. When it switches its name to the Democratic Party, that's the name it still has. So the modern Democratic Party, first the Republican Party, is the oldest political party in this country. The modern GOP is a different organization, begun in the 1850s. So that party, the Republicans, later the Democrats, is our oldest party, and except for the Tories in England, it's the oldest political party in the world. A second thing Madison does is to found partisan media. And this is a newspaper that starts in Philadelphia in 1791 called the National Gazette. Madison finds the first editor. He's an old school friend of his from Princeton named Philip Freneau. They were in the same debating society in Princeton together. But after graduation, Freneau has come down in the world a little bit. He's been a privateer. He's been a ship's captain. He writes journalism. He writes poetry. His career has not been so glorious. But Madison gives him a new assignment, which is to edit a new newspaper in Philadelphia. He introduces him to Jefferson, who gives him a no-show job at the State Department. Freneau is a clerk translator, and Jefferson explains to him that his duties will be so light, he can do anything else that he might wish to do. But what he and Madison wish him to do is to edit this new newspaper. Madison sells subscriptions for it to other gentlemen in Virginia. He tells them that it will be an instrument of education and enlightenment. The National Gazette publishes its first issue on Halloween, 1791, and it soon begins to thwack Alexander Hamilton, and soon after that, also President Washington, to the point where Washington speaks in one cabinet meeting of that rascal Freneau. Now, America had a lively print culture throughout the 18th century. There were newspapers, there were pamphlets, there were almanacs. But the National Gazette is the first national partisan newspaper. And it is the ancestor of Fox and MSNBC and National Review and the New Republic and the Nation and every other partisan and ideological organ we've had since then. But Madison being Madison, he does a third thing that's maybe even more important than the other two. He thinks about what he's doing. Now, most of the founders, all of the founders, seem to have had a feeling that they could be beyond partisanship. The more intelligent ones, including Madison, knew that there would be contention. Madison writes in Federalist 10 about factions. But he almost has the tone of a scientist handling germs. You know, he knows it's important to handle them, but he's got his surgical gloves on. He's clearly writing with distaste about factions. Yet he is one of the first, he's the first of the founders to break out of this cocoon of thinking that partisanship is something that they can surmount. And he writes about it in a series of essays for this new newspaper, the National Gazette. And a lot of these essays they have the quality of bumper stickers. They laid out the platform for the Republican Party for the next 20 years. They say things like, peace is good, war is bad. Farms are good, cities are bad. poor people, ordinary people are good, rich people are bad. Now, of course, Madison is a rich person, so is Jefferson. But their wealth came from land and from owning people. So that was all right. But Hamilton's friends' wealth came from the New York Stock Exchange and from shorting and selling long and mysterious manipulations. So they were called the opulent, and they were to be resisted. But the most thoughtful of Madison's essays in the National Gazette are on public opinion. Public opinion was a new term at the end of the 18th century. It had been invented in France, and Madison is one of the first people in the English-speaking world to use it. And he uses it in these National Gazette essays. And he says that public opinion must create one empire of reason over the whole country. And every citizen must be a sentinel over the rights of every other citizen. A man like President Washington believed in popular rule, but he believed it worked at election time. On election day, people would vote, then the winners would do their jobs until the next election, when they would either be reelected or replaced with other men who would then have another chance to do their work. So for Washington and so many other founders, popular sovereignty had a kind of cyclical character. It went in waves. Madison is now saying, no, it's continuous. It's ongoing. It's a loop that's 24/7. The people have to continually be paying attention to public issues and public life. And public leaders have to continually be soliciting the people's opinions or educating their opinions. He's foreseeing the world that surrounds us that we take for granted. The world of polling, of focus groups, of advertising, of constant campaigning. He's foreseeing it, and he's helping to will it into being as early as 1791 and 1792. Now, there are some drawbacks to this new world. I just want to talk about one that affected Madison in his own presidency. Thomas Jefferson becomes president in 1800. Madison is his Secretary of State for 8 years. Then in 1808, Madison is elected the fourth president. And in 1812, on the eve of his second race for the White House, he asked Congress to declare war on Britain. You have to remember that the early republic exists in the shadow of a world war between first revolutionary France, then Napoleonic France, and most of the other powers in Europe, primarily Great Britain. It's a 25-year-long conflict. It's longer than World Wars I and II put together. It's as violent as either of them. It's as ideological as the Cold War. And we are a small power at the edge of this maelstrom. And the two great contending powers are Britain and France. Both of them ignore us and insult us and slight us. But Britain, because it's a maritime power and because we share a border with it, with Canada, has more opportunities to treat us badly. And so by the summer of 1812, Madison asks Congress to declare war on Britain. Now, one of the greatest general to emerge from the War of 1812 on the American side is Winfield Scott. He would become the greatest general between Washington and Grant. And when he was an old man, he wrote memoirs. And he remembered what the officer corps was like at the beginning of the War of 1812. He said it was composed of imbeciles and ignoramuses. He said the older revolutionary officers had fallen into habits of intemperate drinking. The younger ones he called swaggerers who were fit for nothing else. And indeed, the beginning of the War of 1812 was a series of disasters. 6 months of disasters. We lost Detroit to the British. Our troops would not attack across the Niagara River into Canada. They were militia. They said, we only have to serve in New York. We don't have to cross the border. The only victories were at sea. Now, President Madison, presidents, no president, is responsible for picking the officer corps, but he is responsible for picking the service secretaries who oversee the officers. So who did Madison have at his right hand as he began this war? His Secretary of War was a man named William Eustace. He'd been an army doctor in the Revolution. He'd got his job as Secretary of War because he was a Republican congressman from Massachusetts. He was completely overwhelmed by administration. One man described him sitting in his office all day looking at ads to see where he could buy 100 hats or 200 shoes for the troops. This is not what you want your Secretary of War thinking about. The Secretary of the Navy was a South Carolina politician named Paul Hamilton, no relation to Alexander. Hamilton was an alcoholic who quit work at noon. So these were the two men with whom Madison was going to take on one of the great superpowers on the earth. And I think the reason he was surrounded by these men is his focus on politics. These men got their jobs because they were good political allies. They had backed Madison up in a fight he'd had with a Secretary of State that he'd had to get rid of. It was an internecine split in his cabinet. These guys had been good soldiers. They'd stood up for him. The only problem was they could not do the jobs that he had put them in as Secretary of the War and Secretary of the Navy. Now, to Madison's credit, after 6 months, he got rid of them. The men he replaced them with were much better, and the quality of American officers and fighting improved dramatically over the course of the war. The turning point, or at least the symbolic turning point, is probably the Battle of Chippewa in 1814. This was a battle on the Niagara frontier. It didn't have any strategic effect, but it's interesting because it's the only battle in the War of 1812 where British and American regulars in equal numbers face each other on a plane head to head. And the Americans chewed the British up. As the battle was beginning, the British general commented, "Those are regulars, by God." And he said it with surprise. He wasn't expecting it. They weren't bumpkins and farmers anymore. So we did manage to improve, and that is to Madison's credit. But the debacles of the beginning of the war, I think, were an effect of too much attention to politics, not enough attention to the task at hand. However, consider the alternatives. It seems to me the alternatives to our political system are either anarchy or stasis. Stasis would be, I don't know, Mubarak for 30 years. Anarchy would be so much of what the Arab Spring has become. And if those are the alternatives, I think we're happy to have politics. For all its problems, it's a better alternative. And Madison is certainly the father of the Constitution, and he is also, and perhaps equally worthily, the father of modern American politics. Thank you very much.
We have time for a few questions.
Okay, do people have to go to mics or anything, or just shout it out?
We do have mics, and there's one down.
Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute. I want to press you on your point about Madison foreseeing the legislative battles and some of the negative effects of politics that we see now. For example, it's kind of the conventional view of historians is that he was short-sighted. His faction against faction theory failed to foresee log rolling and some of the other ways in which factions get together with factions to the double detriment of society instead. What can you say about that?
Well, I think you're referring to Federalist 10, where he, you know, he writes quite a bit about factions. But of course, that's 1787, and his great period of political creativity, of creatively thinking about politics, comes a few years later. Madison is never frozen. He's always responding to new things that happen and to new issues that come up, and always thinking creatively about them. And you know, he certainly knows about log rolling and stasis, and he had to deal with it as president. I mean, there was a faction in the Senate. It was called the Invisibles, and that was one congressman called them that. And there were three senators, a man named Michael Lieb from Pennsylvania. He was sort of a Philadelphia ethnic politician. His base was Irish and German immigrants. Then there was a man named Samuel Smith from Maryland, and then also William Branch Giles from Virginia. And these three guys would vote against the Madison administration largely for spite, consistently. And they really hampered him and bollocksed him up, and he was quite aware of it. John Randolph of Roanoke had a great comment on Giles. There was a question of who would be Madison's first Secretary of State, and Samuel Smith wanted his brother Robert to hold that job. Giles felt that he ought to have it for himself. And John Randolph's caustic comment was that Smith should have the job because he could spell. So he thought he was better than Giles. But no, certainly Madison could write you the book on log rolling and gridlock and deadlock because he lived it. But never bet against James Madison. I mean, this guy is very tough. He never quits. And the history of the early republic is littered with the shattered careers of people who got in his way. And he almost always prevailed. Sometimes it would take a long time, but never pick a fight with this guy.
Thanks.
Okay, next.
Andy Stevens from that historic state of Virginia. How much credit do you give George Mason for the Bill of Rights? Do you go along with the notion that Madison simply tinkered with Mason's Virginia Declaration of Rights?
No, when Madison is a convert to the idea of having a Bill of Rights. It doesn't even come up in Philadelphia till the last week of the convention, and Mason is the man who brings it up, and he says, you know, look, we have the state Bill of Rights. It'll take us half an hour to write one. Why don't we just do it? But, you know, this is September already. Everybody's tired. They want to go home. And Roger Sherman says, well, the state Bill of Rights will still be in effect, so we don't need a national one. Why should we even have one? So they send the Constitution, as you know, out to the world without a Bill of Rights. And Madison's view, his first view, is that they would be paper barriers. That's a phrase he uses in a letter to Jefferson. And Madison helped Mason in the writing of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. It was mostly Mason's handiwork, but Madison was part of that committee in 1776. This is Virginia's Bill of Rights. And he actually toughens up the language on religious liberty. Mason wrote about toleration, and Madison said, no, that's not good enough. It has to be free exercise, which is a very important conceptual shift, because toleration is from people who tolerate you. You know, but free exercise means everybody has a right to this. So, you know, Madison was involved in writing Virginia's own Bill of Rights, but what he said to Jefferson is, I've been all these years in the legislature, and every time it's wanted to violate it, it's done it. You know, it's just done it. It's a paper barrier. It hasn't accomplished anything. But he changes his mind, and for two reasons. One is Baptists in his own state. Virginia had an established Anglican church as a colony, and it was still very strong after independence. Baptists were a new sect beginning in the mid-18th century, and they were very badly treated in Virginia. There was one minister who was thrown in jail in Culpeper County, which was the next county then to Madison's, and he said, when I tried to preach the words of my dear Redeemer through the bars of my cell, a jailer would put a bench in front of it and make water in my face. Now, this was not Barchester Towers. This was nasty, ugly stuff. And it enraged Madison. It just enraged him as a young man. It's the first public issue that gets his attention as early as 1774. So he sticks up for Virginia's Baptists, and they know it. They know he's their friend. So when the Constitution leaves Philadelphia without a Bill of Rights, and they're alarmed, you know, they want a guarantee of religious liberty, they let Madison know about it. So he's hearing from his allies back in Virginia, and he's responsive. He's also hearing from his best friend, Jefferson, who's in Paris, and Madison is constantly corresponding with him and keeping him up to speed with what's happening in Philadelphia and other states. And the form of Jefferson's answers is always the same. You know, he always appreciates what his younger friend is doing, he congratulates him, he encourages him, but he always says, but the one thing it lacks is a Bill of Rights. You know, and he keeps going back to this, and I almost think by like letter six, Madison must be, you know, come on, you know, I'm the one here actually doing this, and you're just sitting in Paris hawking me about a Bill of Rights. But it does have its effect. And the way Madison finally comes to think of it is that he writes Jefferson. He says, you know, I have finally concluded, I do conclude, that if rights are spelled out in the Constitution, over time, they will affect people's thoughts and people's behavior. He doesn't say they'll be a teaching tool, but that's what he means. So he's shifted from seeing them as just a paper barrier to seeing, no, they have an educational effect. They will change people's thoughts and behavior, so therefore we should do it. So that's how I see his conversion process from not caring whether the Constitution had a Bill of Rights to becoming a supporter of putting it in there.
Professor, my name is Briard. I'm the chair of the Paris chapter of the Federalist Society. So first, I want to thank you for having mentioned my country, which, as you know, carried in its arms the young American nation. And second, I wanted to ask you about the influence of the French thinkers on James Madison's work. I'm thinking especially about Charles-Louis de Secondat, Baron de Montesquieu. Do you have some insights about the intellectual influence of the French thinkers on Madison? Thank you.
Well, French is one of several languages that Madison knows. One of his jobs during the Revolutionary War, he's on the Governor's Council in Virginia, and he translates any French document that comes their way until they break down and hire a translator to do it. But he reads French. He is up on French, recent French writings. He asks Jefferson to send him a cargo of French books when Jefferson is in Paris. It's $222 worth. So in 18th century money, that was a pretty expensive cargo. Montesquieu is one of the people he has to refute when he's arguing for the Constitution, because Montesquieu is cited by opponents of the Constitution who say that republics must be small. They can only work in small countries. And part of the evidence for this was historic, that most republics had been city-states or Swiss cantons or things of that sort. And Montesquieu does say that you know, citizen oversight and citizen participation can only really work where people, in effect, know everybody and know intimately what's going on. And that a republic can't work if the nation is too large. Now, if Montesquieu is right, then that's bad for the Constitution, because America is already goes from Maine to Georgia, and it's long grown behind the scale of a city-state. So maybe the best thing America could be is, like the Articles of Confederation, be a league of 13 smaller states and maybe more states as more states are admitted. So Madison has to go head-to-head to Montesquieu. And he develops the idea, the climax of it is in Federalist 51, that the complexity of the new Constitution is a good thing. It's good that it's such a contraption, that there is a president who is independently elected, that there is a Senate and a House of Representatives which are each elected in a different way, that there is a judiciary, and that these all coexist with 13 state governments and more as more states come in. And he says each of these branches and the men who serve in them will keep an eye on the activities of all the others. And he writes, his famous phrase is, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. But so here he's doing an intellectually rather bold thing, because Montesquieu was extremely popular in the United States. If you read Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, you would think that Montesquieu's first two names were the celebrated, because he's always called the celebrated Montesquieu. But so Madison has to contradict the great French hero a little bit on this point. And I think it's a tribute to his ingenuity and his intelligence that he does it so suavely in Federalist 51.
We're going to have to stop there.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you.